This is an ABC podcast.
This is Pacific Beach on ABC Radio Australia. Today on the program, several Pacific governments have been forced to publicly declare that there are no cases of the deadly coronavirus in the region, as social media is in overdrive, though with rumours. We're going to look at why that is the case. Also coming up, the head of police in PNG wants to go after so-called cop killers and his renewed calls for the death penalty in the country, but some argue that is not the answer.
The police commissioner is seeing one side of the coin. I don't agree with him. He shouldn't just say the death penalty on those who are, you know, shooting policemen. He should go back and reassess his police team on the ground. How are they treating issues there? How are they talking to the community?
And we hear from the Australian woman who has got her son back from PNG after she claimed that his father had refused to return him.
It was a happy tears all around. He was so excited and it was a lovely day. It was an awesome day and I'm so grateful for it. So I never thought about not getting him back. I was just determined this process was going to work.
But more on that story and more coming up here on Pacific Beach. Good morning, I'm Catherine Grau. First this morning, after months of delays, a long-awaited commission of inquiry in Papua New Guinea has got underway, and a long list of former prime ministers as well as the current PM, James Marape, have been summoned to appear before it. Now, the investigation centres around the controversial $1.2 billion Australian dollar loan that was taken out back in 2014 through the Australian branch of the bank UBS by the then government of Peter O'Neill to allow it to buy shares in the energy company Oil Search. Questions have long been asked since then whether the government followed the correct legal procedures. There have already been other investigations. A report from the Ombudsman Commission in PNG has pointed the finger at several people, including Mr. Marape and Mr. O'Neill, for, quote, wrong and improper conduct. This commission of inquiry is due to sit for just 3 days this week in Port Moresby, but it is expected to continue for months. And on day one, though, only one of the 12 scheduled witnesses appeared. Our PNG correspondent Nashley Whiting was there for the opening.
It was Sir Michael Smarag who did appear and was ready to assist as needed. He was the only witness of 12 who arrived. So that initial witness list is made up of various politicians and academics. Some of them had responded to the request and, you know, advised that they might not be available. Some hadn't responded at all. Sir Michael Smarag, the only one to actually arrive. So the commissioners thanked him for his attendance and he's agreed to come back in April to give his evidence. So Michael was accompanied by Sir Arnold Arnett, another former politician and judge. He was an attorney general. At the end of the hearing, he actually took the moment in front of the media to call out current and former political leaders who hadn't responded and put the onus on them to treat this inquiry with respect and to ensure that there is funding and ensure that they're doing all they can to assist the inquiry and appear before it.
I am not impressed with the attendance or non-attendance of many of the other leaders who have been invited.
That is Sir Arnold Arnett speaking there in Port Moresby yesterday. Now, those who failed to appear will now be summoned. Here's more from reporter Natalie Whiting.
So there's a few of the few former prime ministers and the current prime minister on that list of politicians and academics. So several of them are now being issued with summons. Those that didn't respond or said they weren't available are now going to be issued with summons to appear next month or have a representative to appear for them. So among those that will be issued with a summons is the current Prime Minister, James Marape. Also some former Prime Ministers, Sir Julius Chan, Pius Winkty, will both be issued with summons. The most recent former Prime Minister, Peter O'Neill, was also on that list, but he was only served the request to attend on Friday. So he's not being issued with a summons. His lack of response was deemed acceptable given that short period. So he's still being asked to attend but won't be issued with a summons at this point. So they're hoping that they're requesting everyone to be able to appear next month so that they can set down when they will give their initial evidence.
Well, as we've mentioned, the Commission of Inquiry has certainly been plagued by months of delays, and that's largely due to a lack of funds. So have they been resolved?
They're still facing funding issues. The commissioner and the chairman said that funding promised still hasn't been provided. And so at the moment, they still don't have counsel assisting and solicitors assisting, in part because of those funding delays. So that will potentially push out the inquiry. They say they are able to continue on with some of the work they're doing at the moment, but there is other aspects of the inquiry that they're having to put on hold until they get the funding to get the people in that they need.
That is our PNG correspondent, Natalie Whiting, there. Well, to the coronavirus, which is gripping the world's attention. And in the Pacific too, fear of the deadly, potentially deadly virus is growing, but local governments are urging people not to panic or spread misinformation. So far, the only deaths have been in China. The toll now stands at 81, and there are more than 3,000 confirmed cases worldwide. Experts say, though, that that makes the fatality rate fairly low at this stage. In the city where it all began, Wuhan, both Chinese locals and foreigners remain in lockdown as government officials try to contain the spread. That has left many foreigners, including Pacific University students, calling to be evacuated. And there is mounting pressure, too, on the Australian government to get the 100 citizens or so who are there out as well. But there are signs that foreign governments may struggle to evacuate their citizens, with foreign diplomats told that China's government can handle the situation. With more, here is the ABC's China correspondent, Bill Birtles.
As the death toll rises and the number of cases expands, diplomats from multiple countries are still scrambling to get their citizens out of the epicentre zone. The Foreign Affairs Minister, Maurice Payne, has conceded it will be significantly difficult to get Australians out. The BBC's reporting that China's Foreign Ministry convened a meeting of ambassadors in Beijing, with one diplomat reportedly saying the message from China is clear, that China's government has things under control and there's no need for foreign governments to be planning the evacuation of their citizens. The US, which has a consulate in Wuhan, is flying a chartered jet to get staff and other Americans out. A US businessman based in Wuhan, Jason Godio, says he and his family were offered seats on the plane but declined.
I'm not taking that offer. I mean, I'm a different kind of person, and I don't feel like being held captive in the US borders for 2 weeks with my children under quarantine. Any person that leaves this place from Hubei will be held quarantined in their own country before they let you go. They make sure you're not sick, that you're not carrying the virus. It's not a great option. So, I mean, for me, it's to weather out the storm. If it hits me, it hits me. If it doesn't hit me, it doesn't. But at the end of the day, I'm screwed wherever I'm at. You know what I mean? I'm screwed.
On the ground in Wuhan, China's second-ranked leader, Li Keqiang, has tried to boost morale, touring a hospital and talking to medical staff.
Stay healthy and protect your own lives, because your job is to save lives and protect people. People across the country are relying on you.
The sight of a senior leader in a city many across China believe to be widely contaminated may help to ease anxiety. Resident Jason Godio says the restrictions in Wuhan have forced everyone inside.
I've been here in China for the last 12 years. And never once I've ever seen here, this place where my wife's family's from, a complete ghost town. Normally, there's so much traffic, you can't move. To tell you the truth, it's basically martial law is going on here. Like, the government has taken over. It's military at the borders. You cannot exit this place.
The restrictions on movement are now reaching beyond the epicenter in central China. The virus has spread to almost every province, and local authorities, under huge pressure from Beijing, are scrambling to play catch-up. Some people in major cities who have been to Wuhan are now getting visits from police, who are ordering them to stay home and self-quarantine for 14 days. It sounds highly disruptive, but after missteps in the early weeks that allowed the virus to spread, China's government now appears determined to make up for it.
That is the ABC's China correspondent Bill Birtles there. Well, meanwhile, several Pacific governments have been forced to publicly declare that there are no cases of the coronavirus in the Pacific. Social media in overdrive, though, with rumours. In Samoa, where many people remain on edge after the recent deadly measles crisis there, the government rejected what it said were fake claims that two students were in quarantine with the virus. But it has confirmed that two Samoan sailors who returned home at the weekend after working overseas are in quarantine as a precautionary measure only, it says, because they spent 2 days in China in transit. Similarly, in Papua New Guinea, the health department was also forced to, via its Facebook page, declare that there are no cases there, and it also urged people to avoid rumours and misinformation after a Chinese man's name, his photo and other personal details were shared widely yesterday on both Facebook and in WhatsApp messenger groups with claims that he had the coronavirus. PNG's national broadcaster NBC even took to its own Facebook page to urge people not to believe these posts being shared online, but instead to turn to media organisations for reliable information. But why is it that such health emergencies seem to trigger this kind of reaction? I spoke with the social media expert Jopé Tarai earlier for his thoughts.
It's not a surprise considering the amount of people that are online and the active users that are across all different platforms, but also at the same time, because this is such a global issue and news organizations are sharing and talking about it, a lot more Pacific Island people are very concerned as well, because we have vulnerable facilities. We are quite vulnerable in terms of our health services and even for our borders and how we are protected. So it's only understandable that more and more people are concerned and discussing this online.
And obviously there are different discussions going on, some of them quite specific to certain countries. In PNG, for example, many of the conversations have been about reports being shared by social media that a man is in the country arriving from China, who people have accused him essentially of having the coronavirus. The health minister, we understand, is now coming out and saying that he's being tested, but there is no need to be fearful. Whereas in Fiji, it's slightly different. People are having conversations about the government's response and ability to handle the potential of the coronavirus coming to Fiji.
Yeah, I think for Fiji, it's a bit on that different angle. For PNG, obviously, a concern is sharing people's information online, which clearly is a violation of people's own identity and privacy for that matter. But for Fiji...
Just to explain that for our listeners. So with these posts, people have actually been sharing what we would understand is an actual copy,
passport,
a photo of the man's passport with his birth, all of his details, the passport number and his photo. So as you say, a breach of his privacy.
Yeah, and that really has a lot of issues around breeding, you know, people becoming vigilantes and things like that, which obviously should be a concern for the authorities in creating a lot more widespread messages for the public to take on and to be a bit more aware and a bit more cautious about what they want to do about the issue and just to protect themselves more rather than having to attack individuals. But for Fiji's case, I think a lot more people are eager to see what the authorities are going to do with this claimed cases. And also, I think it's more important too for the authorities to advise people on what are some of the things they need to do to protect themselves, like basic sanitary products and what they can do with that, where they can get it, and some of the places that they need to be aware of, where they need to protect themselves when they're moving around in public or going through airports, what are some of the things that they can do so that it can allay the fears that's really building up.
Interesting you say that, because I do recall that Fiji's health authorities have, from probably even on Thursday last week, been speaking with the local media at least, talking about the measures that they would be introducing there, quite confident that they would be able to handle or were prepared for the coronavirus should it make its way to Fiji. So I wonder as well, because there is research that is out there that shows that often fake news, misinformation spreads much more quickly via social media than actual factual information. So perhaps people aren't actually getting this information from the official media organisations compared to this, the other sort of fake news.
I think it for Fiji's case, it has really a lot to do with how people have perceived the approach of the authorities towards particular health issues. Recently, we just had the measles outbreak, and still there were quite a fair amount of concerns about how that was handled. And so I think a lot of the organizations really will have to try and overcome how things are being spread on social media. But also at the same time, I think the more messages of how people are protected will really create a little bit more ease for people that are online.
That is the Fijian researcher Jope Tarai from the University of the South Pacific. And we've just shared a story from ABC News on our ABC Radio Australia Facebook page that takes a look at what exactly the experts know about the dangers of coronavirus and what happens when people are infected. So worth taking a look. It might help allay some of the fears out there. Papua New Guinea's police commissioner is calling for the death penalty to be imposed on people who kill police officers following the death of a policeman at the weekend in the Highlands province of Enga. Commissioner Manning says that legislators need to take action against cop killers, but it's a message that hasn't resonated with everyone, as Evan Wasuka reports.
The Porgera gold mine is the second largest mine in Papua New Guinea, but in recent years it's been plagued by lawlessness and more recently tribal violence. A recent police operation to quell tribal fighting and clamp down on illegal mining led to the death of a policeman at the weekend. Police Commissioner David Manning in a statement said,
"An attack on police is an attack on these institutions. The death penalty must be imposed on anyone who kills a policeman. I am therefore calling on our legislators to take this into consideration and amend or enact appropriate laws to serve as deterrent to such criminal behaviours."
Under PNG's criminal code, the death sentence can be imposed for killings linked to accusations of sorcery, aggravated rape and robbery. 16 people are currently on PNG's death row. But since it was introduced as law in 1991, the death penalty has not been carried out, and this week's call for it to be put in place for police killers has not gone down well with one women's group. Monica Nita is with PNG Women for Change.
The police commissioner is seeing one side of the coin. He's seeing the death of a cop here. It's not really seeing the cause and effect.
She's also from Porgera and knows the problem there all too well.
I don't agree with him. He shouldn't just say the death penalty on those who are, shooting policemen. He should go back and reassess his police team on the ground. How are they treating issues there? How are they talking to the community? How are they dealing with those people who are illegal miners and the people that are within the vicinity of the mining area? There must be a continuous dialogue, communication with the landowners, the people living there.
Jonathan Parai is with the Porgera Justice Foundation. He wants peace for the people of the area and is calling on tribal leaders to hand over the suspects to police.
And also I'm calling on the police to restrain from creating more problems. Try and make peace and send all the lawbreakers to the hands of police.
But Mr. Parai says the police commissioner is irresponsible by calling for the death penalty for police killers.
The police commissioner to push for capital punishment or death penalty for killing police only is a little bit unfair. That law should be applied to everyone, whether they kill a policeman, whether they kill a prime minister, whether they kill an ordinary man.
But Mr. Parai acknowledges that if the death penalty was implemented across the board, it could have positive results as it ties in with local culture.
It is fair and traditionally accepted for killing another person who takes the life of the other person.
As for Monica Nita, she's not convinced. She says more empathy is needed by police to solve the violence problem that PNG is experiencing.
Put yourself in the shoe. Put your daughters and sons in their shoe. Don't talk because you have a rank and file in an organization that you try to, get media attention or you're trying to please whoever that is. You talk as a parent, as a father or a mother.
Pacific Beat has sought comments from the Prime Minister's Office and the Justice Ministry.
That is Evan Wasuka reporting there. Well, an Australian woman has regained custody of her son several years after he went to visit his father in Papua New Guinea. The Australian government had previously told Charmaine Backhouse that there was little it could do to help her regain custody of her son Isaiah because PNG was not a signatory to an international convention. But she says she refused to give up and instead was able to use PNG's child welfare legislation to bring her son back to Australia, as Liam Fox reports.
Last month, Charmaine Backhouse spent Christmas with her son, Isaiah, for the first time in 5 years.
It was happy tears all around. He was so excited and it was a lovely day. It was an awesome day and I'm so grateful for it.
Until last month, Isaiah had been living in PNG's capital, Port Moresby, with his father, prominent doctor Duncan Dobunaba, who's the chief anaesthetist at the country's health department. The now 9-year-old went to Port Moresby in 2015 when his parents' relationship ended. According to Ms. Backhouse, she and Dr. Dobunaba mutually agreed at the time that Isaiah would go to PNG and temporarily live with his father while she moved from Brisbane to Broome in Western Australia. But since then, she claims, Dr. Dobunaba refused to send him back to Australia, despite the boy being an Australian citizen who entered PNG with an Australian passport on a visa that expired in April 2016. In November last year, when the ABC first reported on Ms. Backhouse's effort to regain custody of her son, Dr. Dobunaba said via text message, "There are always two sides to a story, and it is not entirely true that he refused to allow Isaiah to travel to Australia." He declined to comment further. Ms. Backhouse initially approached the Australian Attorney General's office for help to bring Isaiah back, but was told there was little the government could do because PNG is not a signatory to the Hague Convention on the Civil Aspects of International Abduction. The convention provides a process for a child to be returned to their country of habitual residence for custody issues to be dealt with. So instead, she searched for an avenue in PNG to try and regain custody, and came across the country's child welfare legislation called the Look Out in Pikinini Act.
I searched up anything to do with family law, to tell you the truth, and then I came across that link and I read it thoroughly and I read the whole lot over and over and over again for about a week, and I was trying to get in contact with any family services over there. I Googled a lot of it.
Fortunately for her, the Act was revised in 2015. The revised legislation established both the Office for Child and Family Services and PNG's Family Court, which has the jurisdiction to determine matters relating to child custody. Ms. Backhouse was able to contact the office, and early last December, it helped her to successfully apply to the Family Court for custody of Isaiah and permission to bring him back to Australia.
I'm very grateful for how they assisted me. I never thought about not getting him back. I was just determined this process was going to work, to use the Look Out in Pikinini Act. And if that would have failed, I would have found some other avenue, and I would have still continued to keep fighting to get my son back.
An official with the Office for Child and Family Services says the case is the first time a foreigner has used the legislation to gain custody of a child in PNG. Despite her success, Ms. Backhouse hopes the PNG government signs up to the Hague Convention so that in future there's an easier process for people that find themselves in similar circumstances.
I shouldn't have had to have gone through this ordeal, and it's cost me a lot. My emotions, my mentality, it's hurt my pocket big time, and that's all I've had to do was work overtime just to get the money to get over there.
That is Mother Charmaine Backhouse, Liam Fox, our reporter. Well, finally this morning, can cultural knowledge help one's surfing skills? Perhaps not quite, but a new program here in Australia is reconnecting Indigenous students with their traditional customs. At the same time, they're trying to identify the next wave of riding superstars, as Anthony Pansia reports.
It's the kind of classroom most students can only dream about. The pristine beaches of Margaret River, the perfect location for these Indigenous students to learn about their ancestral ties with the ocean and sharpen their surfing skills to hopefully one day represent WA at the National Indigenous Surfing Titles.
For us, it's, hopefully one day one of these young boys and girls will get over to the Indigenous title at Bells Beach and get a chance to put Indigenous surfing in WA back on the forefront.
It's good fun for us kids doing this and surfing, getting this experience to do more things to do.
Surfing skills, though, are just one part of this unique program that sees students from three schools mixing it up with cultural knowledge passed along by local custodians.
A lot of the skills haven't been handed on, And that's what we're trying to do, basically, is transition cultural knowledge onto the younger generation.
It's also hoped the two-pronged approach will equip the students with choices beyond their final year at school.
If they want to pursue a career in surfing, or they could go into, like we say, with the cultural side of it, they go into cultural tourism, so teaching people about their country.
The students' teachers say the lessons about ocean awareness and Indigenous culture is already having a positive impact back in the classroom.
It's making the kids want to go to school more. They're more engaged when they're there. They're stronger and healthier, and they're feeling more connected to who they are and to each other.
Oh, pretty interesting.
Yeah, it's really interesting knowing what you can do with all the ropes and everything.
And there's already plans to take the program to other parts of Western Australia.
It's Anthony Pansia reporting. That's it for Pacific Beat today. Pacific Mornings continues next.